is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It was 20 years ago that Professor Albert Bloom at the University of Chicago wrote this fascinating book entitled The Closing of the American Mind. Alan Bloom was a professor in the Department of Humanities, the University of Chicago, and their Committee for Social Thought. Among the intellectuals of the 20th century, Alan Bloom was not known to most Americans until he published this book that became an unexpected bestseller. And it's because he diagnosed what for many people had already been known to them through intuition as the big problem. And that is the infusion of postmodern ideas, as we would now call them, of the idea of the relativism of truth. All of this coming into America's academic life. And he had the credibility, holding one of the highest chairs there at the University of Chicago, one of our most elite universities, to diagnose the problem. There still is the big question, 20 years later, as to why a book about such a deeply philosophical subject would become one of the raging bestsellers of the 20th century in America. We're going to be talking about that. My special guest is going to be Dr. Mark Coppinger, and we're also going to have a special guest with us on the line from Georgia. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. Some of you, no doubt, read the book when it came out. Others of you will remember having heard about it, and to be honest, a large number of those in our listening audience weren't even born when this book was published, but you are, if in that age cohort, likely to be in a university now where you're seeing very much what Alan Bloom was talking about 20 years ago. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. At my website at albertmohler.com, M-O-H-L-E-R.com, I wrote an article overnight really prompted by a recent article by William Salatin of Slate.com. William Salatin is not pro-life. He's not conservative, but he's the best writer and reporter out there on biomedical and ethical issues. William Salatin at Slate.com wrote an article suggesting that in the aftermath of the Gonzalez versus Carhart case, that's the Supreme Court's decision on partial birth abortion, allowing the government to ban the practice. He said, in light of this, it's important that those who support abortion understand that the real enemy is not the U.S. Supreme Court. It's the ultrasound machine. It's a fascinating article, and he's absolutely right. The great enemy, if you are giving yourself to abortion rights and the defense of unrestricted abortion in America, if you're a big defender of Roe v. Wade, it's not so much the Supreme Court you need to worry about. It's the ultrasound machine. He wrote this article, and it's published at Slate.com. I link to it off of my article. And as usual, he reports not only with a great deal of insight, but with a bit of verve. Listen to what he says here. He says, pro-lifers are often caricatured as stupid creationists who just want to put women back in their place. Science and free inquiry are supposed to help them get over their, quote, love affair with the fetus, end quote. But science hasn't cooperated. Ultrasound has exposed the life in the womb to those of us who didn't want to see what abortion kills. The fetus is squirming, and so are we. Actually, a rather poetic way to put this reality. The fetus is seen to be squirming, is seen to be alive and undeniably human, and for that reason, the ultrasound is what the pro-abortion, pro-choice movement has to fear more than anything else. You know, on this program some time ago, you heard the voice of an abortion rights activist say a line that also poetically gets to the point. She said, the fetus beat us. In other words, when a woman that is contemplating an abortion goes in and sees an image of her unborn child, overwhelmingly, the desire for an abortion is transformed into a maternal impulse to protect what she now sees with her own eyes. It's no longer an unwanted product of conception. It's now a child, a baby. Those who've been in this situation, especially working in crisis pregnancy centers, will tell you that the vocabulary changes almost immediately. Once she sees the picture, it's no longer this thing. It's no longer a pregnancy. It is now a baby. Now, what I find very interesting is that William Salatin is basically pro-choice. I don't know how better to describe his position than that. But he suggests that one of the reasons why the partial birth abortion ban was upheld and why Americans are responding to the whole idea of partial birth abortion with revulsion is because so much of the baby is delivered. In other words, it's seen by the eye before its life is extinguished. And he says, in reality, morally, that shouldn't be any different than the dismembering of the baby inside the womb, but since it's hidden from us there, we don't see what it is. Now, I agree with that entirely. In other words, I'm glad to find someone on the other side of the fence, so to speak, who's honest enough to say, morally, it should be the same thing. But he says the out-of-sight dimension is now being transformed by ultrasound technology. We're going to be able to look, all of us, at what's happening in that womb and understand that this is a baby. Now, Salatan, surprisingly, supports the efforts of several states to require women to see an ultrasound of their baby before they go through with an abortion. I was a little surprised by that myself. But listen to what he has to say here. This is from his article at Slate.com. He says, critics complain that these bills seek to bias, coerce, and guilt trip women. Come on. Women aren't too weak to face the truth. If you don't want to look at the video, you don't have to, but you should look at it, and so should the guy who got you pregnant, because the decision you're about to make is as grave as it gets, end quote. Another word of honesty there. He says, you know, if a woman's going to go through an abortion, she ought to at least know what she's doing. And, you know, if you are an ardent abortion advocate, if you are considering yourself pro-choice, pro-abortion, however you want to phrase it, your big enemy is not the U.S. Supreme Court, it's the ultrasound machine, because the pictures tell the story. I want to make a recommendation to you. I'm going to mention this on my website overnight. There is a book I'm recommending, and I just wish everyone in America could see this book. It's entitled In the Womb by Peter Talek. It is actually published by National Geographic. It's a stunner. If you haven't seen this, you just must see it. Tonight I'll put up the information so you can know how to order it. It is a set of pictures, including 4D imaging technology of the baby in development and the use of models created so that you can actually see the baby through different phases of development. The pictures, and I'm just looking at one right now. This is a picture of a 26-week-old baby I'm looking at in the womb. And, you know, you're just looking at the little eyelids, the eyelashes. You're looking at the perfectly formed face. You're looking at all this. You know exactly what you're seeing here. Fascinatingly, they use these imaging technologies to show you such things as the baby learning to taste, learning through trial and error to get the thumb in his mouth, and just some incredibly, incredibly touching photographs. It looks just like a baby in a crib in so many of these cases, but it's a baby in the womb. And, of course, this follows the progression all the way back from the moment of conception, and they use this incredible electron microscope photography in order to show you actually the sperm penetrate the egg. And so you're actually seeing a moment of conception here, and you actually see the head of the sperm disappear into the egg, and you know that all of a sudden something mysterious happens there. Folks, when I look at that, I have so many thoughts, but one of them is, we're the first generation in human history to be able even to see this. You know, I mentioned to you that I did a project earlier this year of reading histories of medicine, and one of the things that shocked me, even though history is very much a matter of my professional concern, just looking at this, I really was not aware of how little those who founded this country knew about medicine. And it's not just that they were uniquely ignorant, it's just that at the time, the greatest medical knowledge was in London. And the second greatest medical city was Rotterdam, and the third greatest was probably Philadelphia. So you're talking about those three cities being cities of tremendous medical learning. And yet, they weren't sure exactly how conception took place. They weren't sure exactly how the blood was circulated. They weren't sure about anything having to do with disease or infection. They didn't even know about germs. And as for the baby's development in the womb, they were just guessing because all they saw was the product of miscarriages and things like this. The evidence that they saw, they weren't able to see this. Now you can get this book from National Geographic, and you can just thumb through photograph by photograph, chapter by chapter, and see a baby developing before your eyes. And you know what, folks? I saw some of the comments on one of the commercial pages that would sell this book. One of the firms selling it, you know, they can have the comments that the readers can put up. And someone put up saying, I wish this book had never been done because it's going to be used by pro-lifers to further their agenda. You know what? You're not going to need a pro-life advocate. You're not going to need a medical doctor or a pastor or a biomedical ethicist sitting next to you when you look at this book. The book's going to tell the story because the fetus is squirming and so are a pro-abortion activists. The fetus beat us, they say, and no more tremendous and poignant evidence of that than in looking at a book like this and getting the point all over again. Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. I want to recognize today the death over the weekend of Dr. Lee Edward Roberson, pastor of Highland Park Baptist Church in Chattanooga, Tennessee, founder of Tennessee Temple Schools, one of the great defenders of orthodoxy in the last century. One of the things I most respect him for is that he was preaching right up virtually to the week of his death at age 97. May we be found just as faithful. We'll be back to talk about the closing of the American mind and what it means for America now, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. It's 20 years ago, when Alan Bloom published his book, The Closing of the American Mind. Most people did not know who he was. Now, 2 decades has passed since the book was published. It's an amazing phenomenon of the publishing world over the last, say, quarter century. Because here's a book with some pretty serious intellectual weight to it, making a very serious intellectual argument that became a bestseller. Now, I'll tell you right up front, I think there are an awful lot of Americans who bought it but did not read it. But there were a lot of Americans who read it, and some of them, upon reading it, were incensed. Because the core of Alan Bloom's argument is that the American mind has closed, and he blamed a pernicious ideology of relativism. And amazingly enough, he said, you know, it's always sold as an opening. We're open to everything. But as he points out, a mind open to everything is literally closed to the very concept of truth. Now, we're going to be talking about this book and its legacy. We're going to be talking about the 20th anniversary of the closing of the American mind. A lot has happened in American higher education and in America over the last 2 decades. But an awful lot of the concerns that Alan Bloom was talking about 20 years ago are still the bread and butter concerns of students on many of America's campuses. I think one of the big shifts is that when Alan Bloom wrote this in 1987, he was writing it from the University of Chicago, and it was probably more true then about the elite universities. I think it's basically true now, at least in part, about almost any academic institution. My guest for this part of the program is Dr. Peter Lawler, who is Dana Professor of Government and Chair of the Department of Government and International Studies at Berry College. He is also one of my favorite writers, and we're very glad to have Professor Lawler as a guest on this program. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
You wrote an essay in the Intercollegiate Review, in the special issue having to do with the symposium, 20 years since the closing of the American mind. And Professor Lawler, you said some interesting things there. Number one, do you think that that he was accurate then? Do you think that Alan Bloom was correct in suggesting that relativism was the great problem in the American university 2 decades ago?
Well, I think relativism was the great problem, right? It's this way he explains relativism that I'm not as sure about. It's somewhat of an exaggeration. He understands America today to, or the sophisticated American students, to be souls without longing, to be unmoved by love and death, to be emotional solitaries. And I think this is all way too extreme. From my point of view, what the American student has lost is the words that correspond to his or her longing. And so the characteristic emotion, I think, is more anger. So Bloom describes rock and roll music as kind of the mechanical rutting of animals, music of people without any erotic imagination, without any spiritedness. When I listen to rock and roll music or popular music as it's evolved over the last 20 years, I think the main emotion is anger. If you listen to, and I don't know much about it, hip-hop music, rap music, the main emotion is anger. And the cause of the anger is the words that correspond to the emotions young people still have just aren't there. So they don't know how to talk about love. They don't know how to talk about death. So what relativism does is produce the conclusion that the only distinctions in the world that are real are technological ones, ones that have to do with conquest, control, calculation. and everything else is a matter of preferences. So things that used to be understood to be very fundamental in people's lives, like who to have sex with and why, become nothing but preferences. So those fundamental decisions concerning sex and love are no different than decisions concerning dessert or something like that.
Now, in your essay, you make a couple of points that I think are absolutely essential. I mean, one of the questions I had 20 years ago after I finished reading the book for the first time was, what if you take his diagnosis as accurate? Where do you go from here? Because what I think you're basically left with is the vacuum of Friedrich Nietzsche and Bloom's own atheism. You point out that what's missing here is obviously a sense of anything beyond, say, intellect and the kind of truth quest that Bloom wanted to see his students on. And you also point to the missing element of family and kind of the natural, organic way young people are to be taught these things.
Well, I think that's right. So there's something odd about the book, that God, country, family, friendship, these are all in the past tense. They've been decimated by relativism somehow. They've been decimated by modern philosophy. So you have this Nietzschean conclusion that God is dead, not in the sense that Nietzsche killed God, but Bloom, like Nietzsche, is a reporter. And so it seems like when you read the book closely that the two alternatives are philosophy or nothing. But it's unclear what philosophy is in a positive sense. Philosophy is coming to terms with the fundamental mortality, fundamental transience of all things. So philosophy becomes this merely negative thing. So if you read this book looking for advice concerning how to live, how to serve your friends, family, God, and country, there's nothing there. There's no patriotism in the book, even though this was the era of Reagan. There's no religion in the book, present tense religion, even though this is religion of the third Great Awakening in the country. The women are described as I said before, as emotional solitaries, that the real connections between men and women are just gone at the level, at least, of sophisticated young people. Now, all these things have some truth to it. And if you want to read a book that conveys this truth pretty well in terms of sophisticated campuses today, it would be this great and extremely troubling book by Tom Wolfe, I Am Charlotte Simmons. But if you read that book closely, you'll see all this thwarted love. You see all this status competition. You'd see all this desire for personal significance. You'd see all this evidence that human beings are still human. But the odd thing about Bloom's book is sort of historicist, that history has cast away these fundamental human longings in a way that they can't come back.
And so I guess also, though, I wanted to ask you, there was some good news in your essay. When you look at your students there at Berry College, bright, energetic, very curious young people, do they look like the students Alan Bloom was describing in 1987?
Yeah, I have not seen in big numbers anywhere the students Alan Bloom was described in 1987. But I teach, my college is obviously in the South. It's not a particularly religiously oriented school, but most of our kids are evangelical in some sense, with a good sprinkling of Catholics and even a significant sprinkling of Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox. And so they really respond to the criticism of relativism, which I think was a key to the book's success. But the whole philosophy or nothing thing doesn't move them. They pride themselves in not being relativists, that is, attached to their country, attached to their friends. They all want to grow up to have families, and they all are, in some sense or another, religious in the sense of believing in a personal, somewhat judgmental God. So that part of the book doesn't resonate with them at all. So they think Bloom himself is rather repulsive, although they love the diagnosis of contemporary apathetic individualism in the first couple sections of the book.
Yeah, much as, I would say, as an evangelical Christian, I have to agree with much of Nietzsche's critique of the culture of his own time. Dr. Peter Lawler is Dana Professor of Government and Chair of that department at Berry College. Dr. Lawler, thank you for joining us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll be back to continue this discussion 20 years after the publication of The Closing of the American Mind. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. We'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. It was 20 years ago this month that The Closing of the American Mind was published. It became a blockbuster, and I want to tell you why. I want to tell you why it's important that we talk about it now, 20 years later. It's because this book, sort of like a CAT scan over the academic culture in America, revealed a deep, deep illness at the very heart of what was going on America's university and college campuses. Listen to this. This is the first line in his book. There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes or says he believes that truth is relative. If this belief is put to the test, one can count on the student's reaction. They will be uncomprehending. That anyone should regard the proposition as not self-evident astonishes them, as though he were calling into question 2 plus 2 equals 4. These are things you don't think about. He goes on to say, the relativity of truth is not a theoretical insight, but a moral postulate, the condition of a free society, or so they see it. Alan Bloom looked at the students before him at the University of Chicago, having taught before that at Cornell University, and he said, look, they're souls with no meaning. There's no substance there. All this has been sucked out of them. They come from broken homes where they've learned that trust is not to be trusted. They've given themselves to moral relativism because they've been told that nothing ultimately matters. And so, given the age of college students and all the rest, he said, well, they copulate. And that's what happens. Moral relativism produces this kind of anarchy. By the way, I loved Peter Lawler pointing to Tom Wolfe's novel, I Am Charlotte Simmons. If you want to understand what went on in Duke University with the lacrosse controversy, that novel will tell you actually more than you need to know. But nonetheless, when he wrote about relationships, listen to this. Also, this is Alan Bloom writing 20 years ago. He wrote this. The students of whom I am speaking are aware that all the sexual alternatives and have been from very early on in their lives. And they feel that all sexual acts which do not involve real harm to others are allowable. They do not think that they should feel guilt or shame about sex. They have had sex education in school. They've lived in a world where the most explicit discussions and depictions of sex are all around them. They've had little fear of venereal disease. Birth control devices and ready abortion have been available to them since puberty. For the great majority, sexual intercourse was a normal part of their lives prior to college, and there was no fear of social stigma or even much parental opposition. Now, one of the things that strikes me when I read this is that wouldn't be true when I was in college. At just about the same time, just a few years earlier, would not have been true. But I went to a school where most of the people came from Christian homes, and their parents would have cared about their sex lives and every other dimension of their lives. And that's one of the reasons why it was great to have Peter Lawler from Berry College on. And the most important part of the interview with him was what you heard there at the end, when he said, look, my students don't want to be like this. They don't want to be like the students in Alan Bloom's book. Because they do care about their relationships. They love each other. They love their moms and dads. They love their brothers and sisters. And they love God. And because of that, moral relativism just is not an option. But if you want to understand what's going on in this culture, certainly in this postmodern age, this book is pretty much the dynamite description of what's going on there. Here in the studio with me is Dr. Mark Coppinger, who's professor of Christian apologetics here at Southern Seminary. He and I participated together in a forum on the 20th anniversary of The Closing of the American Mind. Are you glad you read it again?
Oh, I am. In fact, I loaned my other copy out and had to buy a new one and was happy to do it. So I'm freshly stocked now. You know, I was thinking about what he said about kids who love their parents and they lived a fairly straight life down at Berry. I was Billy Baptist, to use Jerry Vine's terms, down at Ouachita Baptist University, and we were like you. We were living fairly clean lives. But then I went to Vanderbilt for graduate school, and I discovered the world that Bloom was talking about. A lot of my colleagues in philosophy were very easy-breezy about sexuality, and, you know, the movies in those days were encouraging it, whether it was MASH or Easy Rider. And one thing that I really enjoyed when I first read Bloom was I think he nailed it, and then I found out he wasn't a Christian. I didn't quite know what he was, and I thought, well, even non-believers recognize that things have gone haywire.
Now, you are right now also pastor of Evanston Baptist Church, right adjacent to one of the great college university campuses in America. Is this still what you see in an institution like that?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, I think it's just assumed that cohabitation or promiscuity are the norm, and you have to be a curious person not to get involved.
The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Kind of a heavy subject today, but the kind of thing Christians need to talk about and think about. 20 years after the publication of this book, most Americans have moved on. We may be the last people on earth who still think this discussion is important, to talk about the fact that truth is not relative and that morality is not merely a social construction. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about the 20th anniversary of the closing of the American mind. And this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. One of the fascinating things that that Alan Bloom really got to in his book was the consequences of divorce. He gave an inordinate, I would think, almost amount of attention to this as a college professor, saying that most of the students he saw at the University of Chicago during the years he taught there who had parents who were divorced, he said, had lost the ability to trust. They didn't even trust the books they were reading. They didn't even trust authors because they had experienced this just collapse of trust in their own lives, and thus they moved on to something else. Now, when Bloom wrote his book, you know, so many things had happened. You've gone through the revolution of the 60s, the flower children of the 70s. This is really kind of in the me generation, as it later became called there in the 80s. One of the reasons why conservatives liked Alan Bloom's book was because there's something deeply conservative about his diagnosis of the problem. But as conservatives read the book more closely, the problem is he seemed to leave a vacuum where relativism is gone. No one's actually sure exactly what Alan Bloom would put in his place. My guest today is Professor of Christian Apologetics at Southern Seminary, Mark Coppinger. Dr. Coppinger, when you think of, for instance, what will be left if you take away this relativistic worldview, what would you propose in its place?
Well, of course, I mean, Bloom was a Platonist, and he thought there were just fixed ideals of friendship and courage and so forth, but they were free-floating. They're really not tied to Scripture. The university is kind of puzzled right now. In our day, back in the 60s when I was in college, really the third rail, the way that you messed up big time was to be repressed, to be sexually repressed or be a killjoy. Now the third rail on the university campus is sensitivity, being insensitive or offending someone. Well, it's relativism all over again. If you have to accommodate everybody and talk nice about every right. possible thing. And so the university has become actually a kind of a lockdown place. Everybody is, very wide open on feminism. Everybody is, you know. Right. And so we have a new kind of absolutism, and it's just filled the gap. I find it one of the most repressive places around. Our students are constantly terrified that they'll misspeak, that they'll hit that buzzer, and someone will be all over them for being insensitive. That's what's filled the gap now, political correctness.
I never expected to talk about this on a radio program, but Plato's dialogue, the Gorgias, which involves Socrates. You remember that Socrates makes the argument that every generation tries to kill off their parents' morality. Hmm. Only to become their parents in very short order.
Right.
And we see that all the time, don't we? I mean, we see a generation that says we're going to be moral revolutionaries, then they have children, and what do? They become their parents.
Right.
Alan Bloom said that cycle was broken in the 1980s. He said these kids don't want to become their parents, and they want to do something else. But the problem, as I see it, is that in killing off what they saw as a false morality, they're left with nothing. It's just pure emptiness.
Yeah, I think it is. It is funny that their parents were sort of like the flower children, so to speak. Everybody was cheering them on for being so laid back, and now the kids have turned into little Nazis in a way. They're playing gotcha all the time with their parents' sensitivities, and it is a reaction to the thing. But they have. Thrown off a kind of libertarianism, and now, in a sense, they've become police, thought police. They're still doing the free sex. They're still getting drunk, but now they do with kind of a grimness that I don't think their parents had.
Okay, now I'm going to say something with which you may disagree, and that's fine. But I'm going to put myself on the line here out of a sense of urgent concern. I'm going to tell a story, and the story was of me being at the University of Chicago just a week ago. Okay. I was there on that campus Monday a week ago, and I was in the Co-op bookstore, which is one of the great right. academic bookstores in the world.
Right.
I've been a member there for years, and I just love to be there. Now, I was there, and I saw a family come down. As you know, it was in the basement of this giant building, and a family came down. I'd say there were two boys, the eldest probably 17, the other one maybe 14. The 17-year-old was there for the preview weekend. We'd seen signs up. We knew that was going on. And the parents were with him. And, I mean, they just looked like wholesome American family. And I saw this boy get down there, and his eyes just lit up, this 17-year-old kid, when he saw all these books and he saw all this. You could just tell he just arrived in the temple. And it was just written all over his face, and he's too young to be cynical enough to try to hide it. And his parents were kind of beaming beside him, having a good time. I prayed at that moment that kid would not go to the University of Chicago. And I want to tell you why. It is because I see so many young people get into an environment like that, and they're not ready for it, and they're not deeply involved in their home life anymore with their family, where they have that center of gravity. They're distant from mom and dad, and they're not deeply involved in the life of a church where they have that center of gravity and that accountability. And the next thing you know, even if they don't give themselves entirely to this, they get sucked into it. They get sucked into this worldview. I know that's a provocative statement, but what I'm saying is when I recommend where parents should send their kids, I'm telling them I wouldn't send my kid to Harvard or Yale or Princeton or Chicago or Syracuse or, you know, UCLA or Berkeley or Stanford unless I knew exactly how they were going to plug in to family and church when they got there.
Right. No, I agree. I remember I worked at a Christian college once on the long-range planning committee, and someone said a goal should be that we would become the Christian Harvard. And another one said, listen, Harvard's a second-rate school. Any school that does not acknowledge the Lordship of Christ and the truth of the Bible is a second-rate school. Why should we stoop to be Harvard? And I think that is at the essence of a good school, that they understand the Lord. Just connecting back to Southern Seminary in the days when they were not affirming biblical inerrancy, it was said that either it killed you or made you stronger. Those who had their
and that's quoting Nietzsche, by the way. His name has come up here before.
Okay. Well, that some of the most remarkable people in our convention today were those who were tried in the fire. Yourself, as an example. But if you are not up to speed on your faith upon your worldview, then you are susceptible. And a lot of kids screwed the top of their heads open, and they received skepticism, and they became quote smarter than the Bible. I think schools do this. Some tough
I think
people.
Parents don't understand
how
seductive it can be.
It's very
because
seductive.
At a very strategic point of life, we all want to fit in. I mean, at every point of life, we do somewhere.
Right.
But especially at that particular time. And the seduction of the intellect is I think, well, I'm going to say this. The lust for learning can be just as strong as the lust for sex and just as much a lie.
Right. Lust for status. Intellectual status is huge.
Folks, these are big issues, and parents are thinking about this. I'm not suggesting that we simply abandon the elite universities, but it does point out the fact that we had better hope and pray that there are gospel churches, evangelical, mind-awake, word-saturated churches near these great universities to help Christians remember what it means to be Christian in the midst of that very challenging environment. We'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. There has to be something more than this. That's what I thought when I first read The Closing of the American Mind. Boy, I loved his critique of the modern academic culture because I knew it to be true. I was already seeing it even where I was studying. I was tasting, sensing, feeling what he was talking about there. And his diagnosis was just as accurate as if he were looking at a CAT scan and saying, there's the tumor. The problem is, I don't think Alan Bloom had an answer on the other side of that. And that is where intelligent Christians have to come back and say, you know, this is where Christianity comes, not merely as a feeling, not merely as a set of emotions, but as an entire worldview that makes the world make sense and to which we are accountable, and we have to bring all other things to account. Without that, we're as rudderless as Alan Bloom. One of the things that also struck me that was central to understanding this book is the fact that after he was dead, Alan Bloom's best friend, Saul Bellow, wrote a novel about him, revealing what everyone who knew him knew, and that is that he was homosexual. And thus, at this point in this discussion, that's most important for the fact that he himself was cut off from that kind of organic union that that he saw missing in his students' lives as well, in terms of family and marriage and all the rest. And needless to say, he too, by that very act, had set himself over against a moral code, and by that very nature had to create a new one in its place. Mark Coppinger, professor of Christian apologetics here at Southern Seminary, also pastor of the Evanston Baptist Church right there on the campus, practically, of Northwestern University. What do you say to those young people, Dr. Coppinger, when they ask you, so what?
So what about the,
life,
the decay
truth.
Or like, yeah, well, look, I tell you, the one thing that I love, in one sense, the university has cleared away respect for truth. There's such chaos now in the academy. I mean, we've talked about this multiversity where we used to have a university. It's a fertile place for planting just the truth of Scripture. There is a hunger that's bubbling up. And you see this in the Anscombe Society at Princeton. You see this in other places, that the church, a clear-spoken church, not a church trying desperately to be relevant. I don't grow a soul patch and wear low-rider pants so I can connect with students. I just preach the gospel, and lo and behold, some unfair number of students say, that's what we've been wanting to hear, the Word of God. So it's a great opportunity today for us to fill in. I think it was a scandal when Bloom showed himself to be a sensualist in his homosexuality.
Yeah, in his own way.
In his own way. And so we can step in and say, thank you for the critique. Now here's the truth of God.
One of the privileges I've had recently was to visit at your church, at Evanston Baptist Church, and see those young people gathered there. And it's another sign of hope. We are living in our own dark time. But let's remember, God's not finished. There are signs of hope and spots of light all over. We'll just see them and nurture them. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.